PhD is short for Doctor of Philosophy. This podcast shares tips of real-life doctoral students who will eventually defend a dissertation at the end of their academic journey.
In this special edition of PhD Tips, we are joined by a special guest who will share their wisdom and five tips for students looking to successfully complete a PhD.
If you have been following the ride, thank you for tuning back in. And if you are new, welcome to PhD Tips.
Dr. Sharday M. Davis is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication and a faculty affiliate of the Africana Studies Institute and the Institute for Collaboration on Health, Intervention, and Policy at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Davis attended the University of California at Santa Barbara and conducted undergraduate research through the Ronald E. McNair Scholars Program. Her work was awarded the Stephen H. Schaff Undergraduate Research Award from the Department of Communication. Dr. Davis earned her BA in Communication and Feminist Studies, as well as her MA in Communication at UCSB. She later moved to Iowa City, Iowa, to finish her PhD in Communication Studies and a doctoral certificate in Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Iowa. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Sharday M. Davis.
All right, well, welcome to PhD Tips, where you, right now, the resident expert on this space, because me, I'm just a first-year student. This information I'm hoping you provide is not just for me, but I hope, you know, this information becomes kind of a North Star for, I like to call the culture, because, you know, we truly are the best shot at being great. So I'm just, you know, happy that you're here to share.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So the first question, you know, just to lighten things up is, you know, what's your name? How are you doing today? So, you know.
Yeah, my name is formally Dr. Sharday Davis. And how am I doing today? Today has been a crazy day. It's been a crazy past few days because I'm trying to find some short-term housing here in Southern California. I'm on a research sabbatical, and because of COVID, things kind of, it just put a monkey wrench in all of my plans. So I'll be out here for fall semester, which is a blessing to be in SoCal and not in Connecticut. But it's just been stressful trying to manage everything. And then on top of that, finding housing, and then I got to do the whole furnishing thing and the setting up the utilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you caught me in the middle of that. That's where my head is at right now, so to speak. Like, that's what's going on in my neck of the woods. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing is, I'm from Massachusetts, so we're neighbors in that way, you know.
Yes.
So we're both New Englanders. That's cool. So sabbatical, that's a word that people probably know about, but don't know all too much about. Mm-hmm. And can you explain, you know, what sabbatical is and how you're kind of spending it?
Yeah. So, and I really, I'm using it, not in the proper sense, because, so a sabbatical in, you know, denotatively is a time, typically a semester long time that you are released from your teaching and service duties as a faculty person. And each university has different, I guess, rules or procedures about how and when someone can earn a sabbatical. But typically it's in your every 7 years, which can average or is supposed to average out to, you get basically earn the sabbatical after you've been promoted, at least in your, you know, the first part of your kind of professional academic tenure. And then once you become full professor, you still earn a sabbatical every 7 years, but there's no more promotions thereafter, of course. So when you first enter, you finish that PhD, you have that, your degree has been conferred, you are now in a tenure track faculty position. As you know, that clock immediately starts, and you have, it's quote unquote, a 6 year tenure process. But really, you have the first 5 years to produce and to publish, whether that's a monograph or a certain number of articles. And then you go up for tenure at the end of your fifth year, which means you submit your materials. And then in your sixth year, that's when you're getting evaluated. So then at the end of your sixth year, typically around April and spring, that is when you find out whether or not you've been promoted. So you go from assistant professor to associate professor. And then that's the end of your sixth year. And then around that time, you then submit a request for your sabbatical, which you then would take in your seventh year, right? So again, every 7 years. And then again, theoretically, it would take someone 7 years to then publish even more, do more service, so that you can be promoted from associate professor to full professor. So then in your 14th year, you would have earned another sabbatical. So that is what that process looks like theoretically. There are other ways in which people can get time off from teaching and service. You can negotiate teaching releases. When you're on the market and you're negotiating, you know, your contract for your job, you can negotiate that. Many universities like give at least one course release. Meaning you don't have to teach one of your two classes per term. But you can also get a kind of a quote unquote sabbatical from postdocs. So UConn is really awesome in that if you get a postdoc, which I did, I'm a Ford Fellow. So I have a Ford Foundation postdoc fellowship. And it's for 1 year. And so UConn has this really cool kind of, I don't call it a loophole, but something they instituted for my college where the money that I get from Ford, I then am just the conduit and I shift that money to UConn. And in exchange, I get a full year off. So I don't have to teach, I don't have to do service. I just focus my time on research. And in turn, by me giving them that money, I then keep all of my benefits. I keep my salary, everything is intact. And they theoretically use that money to like hire someone to teach my classes for the year. So that's a really sorry to be so long winded, but it's a really good, that's really great that you asked that question because there are so many aspects of academic life and specifically faculty life where we just don't know. And like you said, we hear these terms and people throw them around and you're like, but what exactly does that mean? The reason why I say it's not, I misuse that word, but I use it strategically because at least people understand sabbatical and like they use that as like pastors have a sabbatical, right? So they get it. So it's just easier. I don't have to like go down the rabbit hole of explaining it. But really, I'm on research leave for my postdoc fellowship. So So I've been off for a year, but I'm traveling since January.
Cool. And did you say this is your first sabbatical? So you're on the first 7 years?
I am on the tenure track. So I'm a tenure track assistant professor. I'm in my, I'll be starting my fifth year. Fifth year. Yeah. Thank you. But in the middle of those 5 years, I received 2 1-year postdocs. So from 2018 to 2019, I was an American fellow from the American Association of University Women. And then from 2019 to 2020 now, I am a Ford Fellow.
That's dope. Cool. Yeah. I was actually talking about a sabbatical with my soon to be advisor at BU, where I go. We don't get advisors until our second year. So we have like a committee of people we can, you know, hang out with. Mm-hmm. But we choose next year, but she was telling me about sabbatical and know, we were actually talking for like 30 minutes about it. So,
oh,
we
really?
Did it, we did it in 8 minutes. So, yeah, I think you're better already.
Oh, okay. I was like, oh, Lord, these people are going to be like, lady, all right.
No, that was succinct. That was succinct.
Okay, good.
Cool. So, the second question I have is, you know, to kind of, you know, I'm hoping the people that listen to this come to listen to just, I want them to feel like the people that they're listening to are regular people just like them. Because with all the, you know, all the titles that a PhD student has, and if when you graduate and you have your PhD, you know, you're like a legendary figure. But, you know, when you're really looking, it's like, yeah, I'm a regular person. So can you just share like your academic journey? You know, you can start back as far as you want. You can go kindergarten or pre-K if you want, just wherever you want to start.
Yes, that's a my academic journey. I won't go back to kindergarten, but I will go back to college because that's really where it began. I was in my first year. I'm a proud Cali girl. So I wanted to say this earlier to you, soon to be Dr. Freeman, that I don't claim the Northeast. Okay. I am not a Northeasterner. I am a Cali girl through and through. Born and raised in San Diego. And I went to University of California, Santa Barbara.
I was like, I bet she's actually not from up here, but you know, he's from this
I had to make that known. I'm a proud Cali girl. So I was at UC Santa Barbara my first year, and I mean, to be 200% honest, I feel like millennials, we're kind of the lost generation when it comes to college. We got screwed over with loans, you know, and being saddled with so much debt. And also we were this kind of this weird generation where we weren't quite sure what college was for. We knew that we needed to go. But we weren't as, how should I say, strategic. And I can't speak for everyone, but I feel confident saying this relative to the Gen Zers. It wasn't like I need to go to college so I can major in this X, program so that I can get a degree in this, so that I can get this kind of job, so I can make this much money. It's just what you were. That was just a natural part of your kind of like, you know, just academic or educational like matriculation process. You're supposed to go to college. The reason why I say that is because I hadn't really put much thought into like my vocation, like what I wanted to do. And in thinking, again, being really strategic about that. What is that going to look like? How much money am I going to make? How realistic is this? So in my first year, I had a mentor, Dr. Michael Young. He was the vice chancellor at UC Santa Barbara, and he's a Black man. And I would meet with him from
Michael Young. Wait, I think I know Michael. We'll talk about it. Keep going. Sorry.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that might be a small world, though. Michael and Young are relatively common names, but Vice Chancellor of Santa Barbara, that's not too common. So Dr. Young, I went up to his office and just kind of had one of our regular meetings, and he goes, Sharday, hey, what do you want to do? Like, where do you want to go after college? And I hadn't really put much thought to it, but I did know one thing, which is that I've always had dreams of going to New York. And I got into Santa Barbara and NYU and a few other schools, but my parents were not down with this little girl from San Diego going to the Big Apple, living by myself in the city. So my little New York dreams were crushed. And so I was like, well, you know, I think like after this, I'm going to move to New York. And I really love the fashion industry. And I want to be a retail buyer for Bloomingdale's. Now, you may think like, oh, that's a very specific vocational goal. You must have put a lot of thought into that. No. You know where I got that from? Yeah. So I got that from the show Friends on NBC, because Rachel Green, who was my favorite character, was a retail buyer for Bloomingdale's. And they lived in New York and they lived cool lives as young people. And I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. So what did it entail to become a retail buyer? I had no idea. How do you become a retail buyer? I didn't know. I just knew like, oh, that sounds cool. So anyway, I shared that with
you. I have a confession about friends.
What's your confession?
I probably my entire life, 27, I probably watched 10 episodes of Friends. So I know about Friends.
Okay.
I know
about Rachel. I mean, you know, it's a classic depending upon who you talk to, but it's obviously, you know, it definitely doesn't escape controversy, even though it's probably, in terms of content, one of like the least controversial shows. But yeah, but yeah, this little black girl finding, you know, seeing myself in Rachel Green, that's, you know, comical in of itself. But yeah, so I shared that with Dr. Young, and you know, he laughed in my face, and he, in a loving way, Dr. Young is such a like kind man, and he goes, no, that's not what you're gonna do. And I'm like, what you mean, Dr. Young? And he goes, no, you are gonna be an academic. And I was like, huh? He goes, you're gonna be an academic. And he's like, I see you, I'm getting your PhD. And not only being an academic, but I see you being the president of a university one day. And I'm looking at him like, you are out of your mind. I said, Dr. Young, I don't even like to read or write. Like, I don't know how this is going to work. I literally said this to my chancellor. I was like, I don't know. Like, that's not for me. And he goes, yeah, that's what you're going to do. I was like, oh, okay, whatever. So fast forward. The Ronald E. McNair Scholars Program comes to Santa Barbara. Another black man, he was Melvin Oliver. He was the dean of the social sciences at Santa Barbara. And his, I think, associate dean, Beth Schneider, another sociologist, brought it to Santa Barbara. And they were opening it up, accepting applications for students. And so many of my mentors, black mentors specifically, at Santa Barbara were like, you need to apply. And I was like, huh? No, research, boring. I don't want to do that. And so they coaxed me to apply. I'm like, fine, I'll apply. I obliged. I applied. I got an interview. I go to the interview with Dr. Beth Schneider and a few other people. They ask me, again, what do you want to do after graduation? And I told them this during my McNair Scholar interview. gave them my same spiel that I told Dr. Young. I want to move to New York. Da, da, da. And she laughed in my face. And she goes, she looks at the people in the interview and she goes, oh no. Oh no. You're going to be an academic. You're going to be an academic. You're going to get your PhD. And I'm like, if these people don't stop trying to speak over my life. And so how, I don't know, but somehow I got accepted into the program. And do you know, I had the audacity to where I was going to turn it down. There's a moral to the story, people. Follow me. So I was going to turn it down. And more black mentors, but one in particular was like, no, Sade, this, first of all, this is a huge honor. Like, this is like a federally, you know, Department of Education funded program. You should not pass this up. This is for you. And so I took a leap of faith and I accepted, you know, the invitation, and I was a McNair Scholar, and I got paired with Dr. Tammy Afifi in the communication department, and we started doing research together, and that's where my eyes were open. I really fell in love with research. And I think it was because I saw myself. Like, I was able to do work that really reflected me and my experience, which, you know, if anyone knows anything about communication research broadly, it's very white. I mean, social sciences broad, you know, research is very white. It's a lot of white people who are doing research through their lens. That's steeped in white culture, white behavior, but it gets presented as human behavior, right? That this is applicable to everyone. But I'm like, I don't see myself in this. So that's where my journey began. And that's where my love for research began. And I was a double major in communication and feminist studies. So, but Tammy was in the Department of Communication. She was, again, my McNair advisor. And we did work, and I did my project on divorce between black couples, black heterosexual couples. And in that project, I was so fascinated with the black women I had interviewed. And from there, between that and in undergrad, I was still an undergrad, of course, and I was taking a Black feminist thought course. And then that's where it all just clicked. I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to study Black women. I am, screw the men. I don't really care about their interviews, their data. The women, this is interesting. And I just, and again, I research is research. That's a catchphrase among some.
You said research is research?
Research is me search. Research. Yeah. So a lot of interpersonal communication scholars say that. And so, yeah, I ended up like, in a way, like, quote unquote, researching myself, you know, and that's really where it all began. So really, you know, the moral of the story is just like, it's so important to have mentors. It is so important to have mentors. And for anyone who is a mentor, I'm a Christian. So can, like, let God use you, because you really don't know how you are a mouthpiece, right? That's speaking life. Yeah. Into your mentees and showing them and telling them the things that they can do that they never thought they could do. They never thought that they were capable of. Again, yeah. Lord knows where I would be if Dr. Young wasn't in my life. I think about that sometimes, like, what would I have done with my life? I literally don't know.
Maybe if they don't let you become Rachel, you know,
right. I mean, especially at that time, oh my gosh, a little Black girl trying to make it in the fashion industry. Oh, I would have gotten eaten alive. And I was a Cali girl? No. I would have gotten eaten alive. Yeah. Yeah. So that's that's the start of my story. Yeah.
That's a cool story. You answered a bunch of the questions in between. So, like, you know, that was actually really, really good. So this question is, you're finished, so I think it's an opportunity for you to share about what your dissertation was about.
My dissertation, my baby. She was a partial test of my theory, and my theory I wrote in grad school, and out of a grad seminar. I didn't know it was a theory. I just thought it was a collation of different ideas and things I hadn't seen in research and kind of put them together. And my advisor was the instructor for that grad seminar. And she goes, oh my gosh, this is a theory. And I'm like, it is? And that was my first solo authored publication. So for any grad student out there, it takes a while your first time. So, you know, hang in there, but it took about 2.5 years from that grad seminar to it actually getting published. But it's called The Strong Black Woman Collective Theory. And so, I published that theory in grad school, and my journey took me from UC Santa Barbara to the University of Iowa, where I finished my PhD. But all right. At University of Iowa, that's where I did the dissertation. And so, Iowa. So when it came time for us to decide what I wanted to do, I was like, I'm going to test my theory. So my theory, it was a partial test. It was, the theory is about Black women. The theory posits that when Black women gather together, we regulate and reinforce this idea of the strong Black woman in each other. And so Patricia Hill Collins, controlling image, the strong Black woman, and we reinforce that in each other. And we do so as a, recognizing that strength has value. It has like kind of political kind of currency that we need strength in order to survive, and that we kind of accept the costs of being a strong Black woman because the benefits are so necessary. And so the context of my dissertation was, Black women, three Black women friends gathered together, and in one of the women's homes, and I met them there. And one of them was randomly assigned to be a support seeker, and she sought support about a time a white woman committed a racial microaggression. She identified a time, she gathered with her the friend group, engaged in a supportive discussion about that racial microaggression. It was videotaped and audiotaped. They completed some surveys, and it was about a 2-hour home visit. And so I chose that context as a way to test this idea, this theoretical idea that when Black women gather together, that they're going to reinforce strength in each other. So yeah, that's my baby. And she is the gift that keeps on giving.
That's nice. That's dope. Because I know, you know, I learned about, you know, dissertations probably my junior year in college, and that was in 2015. And, you know, people talk about the dissertation, they're like, oh, that thing, you know, they don't even use it or reference it anymore. It's like a relic. But it's so cool that, you know, it's your go-to tool.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And maybe that goes into my tip, but maybe this will be a bonus tip in that I don't want to put too much pressure on people, because a good dissertation is a done dissertation. But if you can, really think about your diss. And if you're going to go into a faculty position, make sure that it's something that you can chew off of for years to come and publish off of. Because when you first start, you just don't have the time or energy to go from a dissertation to starting a whole new project. So, yeah. You know, you want to try to publish off of it. And that's why I say my dissertation is the gift that keeps on giving. I won an outstanding dissertation award from that. I won, I'm on my third, prayerfully, third publication from my dissertation. Two of which were published in the top journals in my field. And both of those articles not only were published in top journals, but also won outstanding research awards from my national and international associations. And when they were conference papers, they both won top conference paper awards. Telling you. And then one of them is just where it's nominated, it's under review now for like our national association's like golden monograph article. So yeah, gift, and it's been cited in the New York Times. Like, yeah, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. So that was a bonus tip. And when I referenced on Michael Young earlier, so it wasn't the vice chancellor at Santa Barbara. I actually know Mike Young at Iowa State University.
Oh yes. Yeah. He went to Iowa. Oh my gosh. He went to Iowa, University of Iowa. That's right.
Yeah. So wait. So are we? So maybe we're talking about two Mike Young. So the Mike Young I'm talking about, currently he's an associate professor in mathematics.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Wow. Isn't that interesting? How we could have totally been thinking we were talking about the same person and we were not. Okay. We are talking about two different people. Never mind. But
still Mike Young. But it's so crazy that you said you finished your PhD in Iowa State, and then I know the Mike Young from Iowa State.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Actually, you know what? Okay, yeah, this is all hilarious. Okay, yes. Dr. Michael Young, my mentor, went to the University of Iowa, I think for his master's or like EdD or something like that. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Iowa in Iowa City. But it sounds like your Michael Young is at Iowa State.
Yeah, Iowa State, yeah.
Des Moines, I think, or Ames.
It's either Michael Young, yeah.
Wow, my goodness. I was like, hey, Michael Young is a very, you know, Michael Young, popular name. Yeah. That's hilarious.
All right, so, you know, last stretch. So you gave us the one, extra free PhD tip. Yes. So you can do five more, or if you want to do four, you can do only four, but you can do five. So what are those five tips that you would give someone on their journey to finishing their dissertation?
Yes. Identify a solid mentor. Sometimes your mentor can be your advisor. You get both, you get a 2-for-1 deal. But sometimes that's just not what it is. This is especially true if you are a graduate student of color. You need to have someone more senior who looks like you and who really understands your experiences. So must have a mentor and really cultivate that relationship. It'll go a long way. That person can be in your department, at your university, or even in your field. Number two, is this for people who are going into an academic job?
I think we can make it open.
Okay, we can make it open. I was gonna say, because that's about all I that's what my expertise is in. Let's see. In your home stretch of writing your dissertation, it can get rough sometimes, and that's honestly where a lot of folks, experience difficulty and never make it, and never make it over the cross the finish line and stay ADD. So I encourage everyone to figure out what your writing system is going to look like. You know, for me, I was on fellowship. I rented a 2-bedroom apartment so that I had a dedicated office space in my apartment. Because I was on fellowship, I didn't have to teach my last year. So I just wrote every day. So I had a very strict schedule about what my day looked like, and I had large blocks of writing every single day. For some people, that may not be feasible, but you have to figure out what your writing schedule is going to look like in the midst of other aspects of your life. That is key. You have to set aside time to write. The third one is,
I might have disoriented you. I didn't mean to say keep it open, not focusing on what you know. So if you want to go in on what you know, do that.
Okay. A bonus tip for writing the dissertation, because I have some thoughts about other aspects of life, but hire, if you have some monies or you can find some monies, hire a copy editor. Because once you're done writing, your eyes will be cross-eyed and you're going to have to edit the thing. And just, it's much easier if you can hire someone to do the editing for you. So that'll be, third tip/bonus tip. For those who are on the job market, connect with other people who are on the market, but where you both aren't going for the same jobs. So for me, I'm an interpersonal communication scholar. So I went and connected with someone who was a rhetorician, and we both were on the market together at the same, kind of market season. And it really helped, because, sometimes it just helps to connect with someone, talk with someone, trash talk with someone, debrief about how your interview went, exchange tips. And so it's just really helpful. But again, try to connect with someone or partner up with someone who is not applying for the same jobs that you are, because then it gets awkward. Really awkward. When you get into an academic position, so you've on the market, you found a job, you've signed your contract, you have moved, your first semester, do not be hard on yourself. A successful first semester in a tenure track position is you being alive. Honestly, being alive and having any just wits about you, you just being a full-fledged adult, you paid your rent on time, you know what I mean? You're getting to work every day and you are staying at least one step ahead of your students when it comes to teaching. That is a successful semester. Do not put any more pressure on yourself to do anything else, because it's a lot. It's a really significant and difficult transition. Once you get to the end of your first year, I then suggest doing some serious strategy planning. I did that in my first summer, the first summer after my first year on the tenure track. I went and took that summer because I didn't really have anything going on. And I created a timeline of what my tenure process was going to look like, in terms of when I'm on the clock. What projects I wanted to do, what data I already had that I could flip into a publication, other projects I was on, and really paced it out to ensure that by the time I went up, I knew I was going to have at least 12 publications. I knew I was going to be ready. But if anyone knows anything about the publication process, it's a long time and really uncertain. Riddled with a lot of uncertainty. So you have to do a lot of forward planning. Those are my, I think I gave you 5 and then 2 bonus ones or 5. As well as
dropping total. Keys. Major, major keys.
And I'll give you one more, which is money. You will go broke moving. It's just the facts of life. Unless you are a trust fund baby, your parents are very wealthy, if you're a regular Joe Schmo like I was, you're going to go broke. And that was even after having moving costs that were paid for by the university, which you absolutely should negotiate. I was in the red $7,000 or $8,000, and I had saved. And I had moving costs, but it's a lot of money. You don't get your first check until the middle of September. So if you can do any saving that summer before you move, or like create a GoFundMe, you know, account and have people put money in, that will help you because it's really expensive and nobody tells you that.
Yeah, that's, and you know, I'm hoping 98% of who's listening to the PhD tips are Black people, and you know, that's major keys, because I even have friends and family, and they're practicing medicine right now, and I didn't even know the amount of money that they have to take out, because you know, it's so much money, and their friends are, you know, across the table from them. You know, they're blowing through their mom and dad's money. That's, you know, play money.
Yep.
And it's crazy. So that's a good, you know, tip. Save that money, more money than you
can even imagine. More money than you even think you need. Save. And like now we have GoFundMe accounts or Venmos and things like that. I didn't have that before. I wish I did. I would have used it. But do not be too proud. Do not be too proud. Graduation, your PhD graduation, set that fund up. Tell them, don't give me a random tchotchke. Set the fund up and say, here, please put the money in here. I will need it for my moving costs.
Great, yeah. Well, so we're at 35 minutes. I think that was a good take. I'm not gonna have to do any editing and to this. It was a good take. You know. Okay. So I like to thank you for coming and, you know, sharing your wisdom information with everyone who's, I hope, will listen. And in the future, if you have friends, or if you know prospective students that might want to share some tips, you know, please reach out to me and let me know that they want to share. And then I think, you know, anything that they have can be invaluable to someone else that might follow them in years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And thank you for having me. My pleasure. It's just, you know, it's important. We have to, you know, a lot of us don't have like a whole bunch of folks in our families who have doctorate degrees, PhDs. Yep. So this can be a really shrouded process. And you don't really know exactly what you're getting into. So again, I just say really latch on to a mentor. And honestly, if I can say this, and I'll shut up, but that the mentor doesn't even have to be a senior faculty person, doesn't even have to be a tenured faculty person. Even just someone who is a few years ahead of you can mentor you, right? So if you're in your first year PhD program and you know someone who is dissertating and almost out, if they have the time and, you know, you all have a good rapport, they could be your mentor. And having multiple mentors isn't bad too, right? So maybe you have a senior graduate student, PhD student who mentors you, and you have a faculty person. They have different knowledge, different vantage points. And it all is helpful. But please don't, you do not have to do this on your own, and you should not do this on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There you have it, Dr. Sharde M. Davis. That's a wrap.
Thank you for tuning in. Check back sometime soon for more PhD tips. Until next time, peace.